men being largely unenthusiastic about butchering their fellow citizens, cousins or not. That meant that most of the men of the regulation survived unharmed. I suppose that the governor might feel that a drastic gesture was required to seal his victory, intimidate the survivors, and stamp once and for all on the long smouldering wick of that dangerous movement. There was a stir and the sound of a horse's hooves. I looked up. Next to me, Bree's head jerked up, her body tense, to see Jamie returning, riding double with Murdo Lindsay. Both men slid off, and he sent Murdo away with a word to care for Gideon, then came at once to me. I could see from the anxious look of his face that he had no word of Roger. He glanced at my face, and saw the answer to his own question there. His shoulders dropped slightly in discouragement, then straightened, stiffening. "I will go to search the field," he said to me, low-voiced. "I've sent word already through the companies. If he is brought in anywhere, someone will bring us word."
"I'm going with you."
Brianna was already taking off her grubby apron, wadding it into a ball. Jamie glanced at her, then nodded.
"Aye, lass, of course. Just a moment, then. I'll fetch wee Josh to help your mother."
"I'll get the horses ready."
Her movements were quick and jerky, without her usual athletic grace, and she dropped the water bottle she was holding, fumbling several times before she succeeded in retrieving it. I took it from her before she could drop it again, and squeezed her hand hard. The corner of her mouth trembled as she looked at me. I thought she meant it for a smile.
"He'll be all right," she said. "We'll find him."
"Yes," I said, and let go her hand. "I know you will." I watched her hurry across the clearing, hands clenched in her raised skirts, and felt the counterweight of fear come loose, plunging like a stone into my belly. Chapter 68. Execution of Orders. Roger woke slowly to throbbing pain and a sense of dreadful urgency. He had no idea where he was or how he came to be there, but there were voices, lots of voices, some talking just beyond the range of comprehension, some singing like harpies in shrill discord. For a moment he felt the voices were inside his head. He could see them, little brown things with leather wings and sharp teeth, banging into each other in paroxysms of interruption that set off small bombs of light behind his eyes. He could feel the seam along which his head must surely split under the pressure, a burning streak across the top of his skull. He wanted someone to come and unzip it, to let out all the flying voices and their racket, to leave his skull an empty bowl of shining bone. He had no real sense of opening his eyes, and stared numbly for some minutes, thinking that the scene on which he looked was still part of the confusion inside his skull. Men swarmed before him in a sea of colours, swirling blues and reds and yellows, mixed with blobs of green and brown. A defect in his vision deprived him of perspective and caused him to see them in fragments, a thin cluster of heads floating like a bobble of hairy balloons, a waving arm that held a crimson banner, seemingly severed from its body, several pairs of legs that must be close by. Was he sitting on the ground? He was. A fly droned past his ear and landed, buzzing on his upper lip, and he moved by reflex to swat it, only then realizing that he was indeed awake and still bound. His hands had gone numb beyond any sense of pain, but the ache now throbbed through the straining muscles of his arms and shoulders. He shook his head to clear it. A terrible mistake. Blinding pain shot through his head, bringing water to his eyes. He blinked hard and breathed deep, willing himself to grasp some shred of reality, to come to himself. "Focus," he thought. "Hold on." The singing voices had faded away, leaving only a faint ringing in his ears. The others were still talking, though, and now he knew that the sound was real. He was able to seize on a word here and there and pin it down, flapping, to examine for meaning.
Example. Governor. Rope. Piss. Regulators. Stew. Foot. Hang. Hillsborough. Water. Water. That one made sense. He knew water. He wanted water. Wanted it badly. His throat was dry. His mouth felt as though it was stuffed with... It was stuffed with something. He gagged as his tongue moved in an unconscious attempt at swallowing. Governor. The repeated words spoken just above him made him look up. He fixed his floating vision on a face. Lean, dark, frowning with a fierce intent.
You're sure? The face said.
And he wondered dimly, sure of what?
He was sure of nothing, save that he was in a bad way.
Yes, sir, said another voice.
And he saw another face swim into view alongside the first. This one seemed familiar, fringed with thick black beard.
I saw him in Herman Husband's camp, palavering with Husband. You ask amongst the prisoners, sir. They'll say so.
The first head nodded. It turned to the side and up, addressing someone taller. Roger's eyes drifted up, seeking, and he jerked upright with a muffled exclamation as he saw the green eyes looking down on him, dispassionate.
"It's James McQuiston," said the green-eyed man, nodding confirmation, "from Hudgens Ferry." "You saw him in the battle?"
The first man was coming into complete focus, a soldierly-looking fellow in his late 30s, dressed in uniform. Something else was coming into focus. James McQuiston. He'd heard of McQuiston. What?
"He killed a man in my company," Green Eyes said, his voice rough with anger. "Shot him in cold blood as he lay wounded on the ground."
"The governor. That's who it must be. Governor Tryon, that was the name."
The governor was nodding, the frown etched deep on his face.
"Take him too, then," he said,
and turned away.
"Three are enough for now."
Hands gripped Roger's arms and jerked him upright, supporting him for a moment, then pulling him so that he stumbled off balance and found himself half-walking, his weight supported by two men dressed in uniform. He pulled against them, wanting to turn and find Green Eyes.
Damn, what was the man's name?
But they yanked him round, compelling him to stumble toward a small rise topped with a huge white oak. The rise was surrounded by a sea of men, but they fell back, making way for Roger and his escorts. The sense of urgency was back, a feeling like ants beneath the surface of his brain.
McQuiston, he thought,
the name suddenly clear in his memory. James McQuiston. McQuiston was a minor leader of the Regulation, a rabble-rouser from Hudgens Ferry, whose fiery speech of threat and denunciation had been published in the Gazette. Roger had seen it.
Why in hell had Green Eyes... Buckley. It was Buckley.
His sense of relief at remembering the name was succeeded instantly by shock as he realised that Buckley had told them he was McQuiston.
Why?
He hadn't even time to form the question when the last ranks broke before him, and he saw the horses beneath the tree, the looped nooses hanging above the empty saddles from its branches. They held the horses by the heads while the men were put upon them. Leaves brushed his cheek. Twigs caught in his hair, and he ducked, turning his head by instinct to save his eyes being put out. Some way across the clearing he saw a woman's figure, half hidden in the crowd, indistinct, but with the unmistakable curve of a child in her arm, a small brown Madonna. The sight brought him upright with a jolt through chest and belly, the memory of Bree with Jemmy in her arms searing through his mind. He threw himself to the side, back-arched, felt himself slide and had no hands to save himself. Other hands caught him and pushed him back. One struck him hard across the face. He shook his head, eyes watering, and through the blur of tears saw the brown Madonna thrust her burden into someone's hands, pick up her skirts, and run as though the devil chased her. Something dropped upon his breast with a heavy slither of a serpent. prickly hemp touched his neck, drew tight about his throat, and he screamed behind the gag. He struggled without thought for consequence or possibility, impelled by the desperation of the instinct to survive. Heedless of bleeding wrists and wrenching muscle, thighs clenched so hard about the horse's body that it jerked under him in protest, he strained at his bonds with a strength beyond what he had ever imagined he possessed. Across the clearing, the child had begun to shriek for his mother. The crowd had fallen silent, and the baby's cries rang loud. The dark soldier sat on his horse, arm lifted, sword upraised. He seemed to speak, but Roger heard nothing for the roar of blood in his ears. The bones of his hands popped, and a line of liquid heat ran down one arm as a muscle tore. The sword fell, a flash of sunlight from its blade. His buttocks slid back over the horse's rump, legs trailing helpless, and his weight fell free in an empty-bellied plunge. A wrenching jerk, and he was spinning, choking, fighting for air, and his fingers scrabbled, nails tearing at the rope sunk deep in his flesh. His hands had come loose, but it was too late. He couldn't feel them, couldn't manage. His fingers slipped and slid on the twisted strands, futile, numb, and unresponsive as wood. He dangled, kicking, and heard a far-off rumble from the crowd. He kicked and bucked, feet pawing empty air, hands clawing at his throat, chest strained, back arched, and his sight had gone black, small lightnings flickering in the corners of his eyes. He reached for God and heard no plea for mercy deep within himself, but only a shriek of no that echoed in his bones. And then the stubborn impulse left him, and he felt his body stretch and loosen, reaching, reaching for the earth. A cool wind embraced him, and he felt the soothing warmth of his body's voidings. A brilliant light blazed up behind his eyes, and he heard nothing more but the bursting of his heart and the distant cries of an orphan child. Chapter 69. Hideous emergency. Jamie and Bree were nearly ready to leave. Smoke-stained and weary as they were, a number of the men had offered to join the search party, an offer that made Bree bite her lip and nod thanks. She was grateful for the offer of help, I knew, but it takes time to move a larger group, and I could see the impatience flare up in red blotches under her skin as weapons were cleaned, canteens refilled, cast-off shoes located. Wee Josh had been mildly apprehensive regarding his new position as surgeon's assistant, but he was a groom after all, and thus accustomed to tending the ills of horseflesh. The only difference, as I told him, making him grin, was that human patients could tell you where it hurt. I had paused to wash my hands before stitching a lacerated scalp, when I became aware of some disturbance taking place at the edge of the meadow behind me. Jamie, hearing it too, turned his head, and then came swiftly back across the clearing, eyebrows raised. "What is it?" I turned to look, and saw a young woman, evidently in a dreadful state, heading toward us at a lopsided trot. She was slight of build and limping badly. She'd lost a shoe somewhere, but still half-running, supported on one side by Murdo Lindsay, who seemed to be expostulating with her even as he helped her along. "Fraser," I heard her gasp. "Fraser!" She let go of Murdo and pushed her way through the waiting men, her eyes raking the faces as she passed, searching. Her brown hair was tangled and full of leaves, her face scratched and bloody. "James? Fraser! Are you?" She was panting for breath, her chest heaving and her face so red it looked as though she might have an apoplexy on the spot. Jamie stepped forward and took her by the arm.
"I'm Jamie Fraser, lass," he said. "Is it me you want?"
She nodded, gasping, but had no breath for words. I hastily poured a cup of water and offered it to her, but she shook her head violently, instead waving her arms in agitation, gesturing wildly toward the creek.
"Roger," she got out, gulping air like a landed fish. "Roger, Mackenzie."
Before the final syllable left her mouth, Brianna was at the young woman's side.
Where is he? Is he hurt?
She seized the young woman's arm, as much to compel answers as to provide support. The girl's head bobbed up and down, shook back and forth, and she gasped out,
"Hang! They're hanging him, Governor!"
Brianna let go of her and ran for the horses. Jamie was already there, untying reins with the same swift intensity he had shown when the fighting began. Without a word, he stooped, hands cupped. Brianna stepped up and swung into the saddle, kicking the horse into motion before Jamie had reached his own. Gideon caught the mare up within moments, though, and both horses disappeared into the willows as though swallowed up. I said something under my breath, with no consciousness of whether I'd uttered a curse or a prayer. I thrust needle and suture into Josh's startled hands, caught up the sack with my emergency kit, and ran for my own horse, leaving the brown-haired woman collapsed on the grass, vomiting from her effort. I caught them up within a few moments. We didn't know precisely where Tryon was holding his drumhead court, and valuable time was lost as Jamie was compelled to stop time and again and lean from his horse to ask directions, these often muddled and contradictory. Bree was gathered into herself, quivering like a knocked arrow, ready for flight but lacking direction. I tried to ready myself for anything, including the worst. I had no idea what preliminaries Tryon might have engaged in, or how much time might elapse between condemnation and execution. Not bloody long, I thought. I'd known Tryon long enough to see that he acted with thought, but also with dispatch, and he would know that if such things were done, 'twas best they were done quickly. As to the why of it, imagination failed completely. I could only hope that the woman was wrong, that she'd mistaken someone else for Roger. And yet I didn't think so. Neither did Brianna, urging her horse through a boggy patch ahead with an intensity that suggested she would be better pleased to leap off the horse and drag it bodily through the mud. The afternoon was fading, and clouds of small gnats surrounded us, but Jamie made no move to brush them away. His shoulders were set like stone, braced to bear the burden of knowledge. It was that, as much as my own fears, that told me Roger was likely dead. The thought beat against me like a small, sharp hammer, the sort meant for breaking rocks. So far, I felt only brief, recurrent shocks of imagined loss. Each time I glanced at Brianna's white face, thought of tiny Jemmy orphaned, heard the echo of Roger's soft, deep voice laughing in the distance, singing through my heart. I didn't try to push the hammering thoughts aside. It would do no good, and I would not truly break, I knew, until I saw his body. Even then the break would be internal. Brianna would need me. Jamie would stand like a rock for her, would do what must be done. But he too would need me, later. No one could absolve him of the guilt I knew he felt, but I could at least be confessor for him, and his intercessor with Brianna. My own mourning could wait. A long time, I hoped. The ground opened, flattening into the edge of a wide meadow, and Jamie kicked Gideon into a gallop, the other horses streaming after him. Our shadows flew like bats across the grass, the sound of our hoofbeats lost in the sounds of a crowd of men who filled the field. On a rise, at the far end of the meadow, stood a huge white oak, its spring leaves bright in the slanting sun. My horse moved suddenly, dodging past a group of men. And I saw them, three stick figures, dangling broken in the tree's deep shadow. The hammer struck one final blow, and my heart shattered like ice. Too late. It was a bad hanging. Without benefit of official troops, Tryon had had no one at hand with a hangman's gruesome and necessary skills. The three condemned men had been sat on horses, the ropes round their necks thrown over tree branches above, and, at the signal, the horses had been led out from under them, leaving them dangling. Only one had been fortunate enough to die of a snapped neck. I could see the sharp angle of his head, the limpness of his limbs in their bonds. It wasn't Roger. The others had strangled slowly. The bodies were twisted, held by their bonds in the final postures of their struggle. One man, one body, was cut down as I rode up and carried past me in the arms of his brother. There wasn't much to choose between their faces, each contorted, each darkened in its separate agony. They had used what rope was to hand. It was new, unstretched. Roger's toes trailed in the dust. He'd been taller than the rest. His hands had come free. He had managed to hook the fingers of one hand beneath the rope. The fingers were nearly black, all circulation cut off. I couldn't look at his face at once. I looked at Brianna's instead, white and utterly still, each bone and tendon set like death. Jamie's face was the same, but where Brianna's eyes were blank with shock, Jamie's burned, holes charred black in the bone of his skull. He stood for a moment before Roger, then crossed himself, and said something very quietly in Gaelic. He drew the dirk from his side.
"I'll hold him. Cut him down, lass."
Jamie handed the knife to Brianna, not looking at her, and, stepping forward, took hold of the body round the middle, lifting slightly to take the strain off the rope. Roger moaned. Jamie froze, arms wrapped tight, and his eyes flicked to me, huge with shock. It was the faintest of sounds. It was only Jamie's response that convinced me that I had indeed heard it. But I had, and so had Brianna. She leapt at the rope and sawed at it in silent frenzy, and I, stunned into temporary immobility, began to think, as fast as possible. Maybe not. Maybe it was only the sound of the body's residual air escaping with the movement. But it wasn't. I could see Jamie's face, holding him, and I knew it wasn't. I darted forward, reaching upward as Roger's body fell, to catch and cradle the head in my hands to steady him as Jamie lowered him to the ground. He was cold, but firm. Of course, if he were alive, he must be. But I had prepared myself for the flaccid meat touch of dead flesh, and the shock of feeling life under my hands was considerable. "Aboard," I said, breathless as though someone had just punched me in the stomach. "A plank, a door, something to put him on. We mustn't move his head. His neck may be broken." Jamie swallowed once, hard, then jerked his head in an awkward nod and set off, walking stiffly at first, then faster and faster, past the knots of sorrowing kin and eager gawkers, whose curious gaze was turning now in our direction. Brianna had the dirk still in her hand. As people began to come toward us, she moved past me and I caught a glimpse of her face. It was still white, still set, but the eyes burned now with a black light that would sear any soul so reckless as to come too near. I had no attention to spare for interference or anything else. He wasn't breathing visibly, no obvious movement of the chest, no twitch of lips or nostrils. I felt vainly for a pulse in his free wrist, pointless to poke at the mass of swollen tissue in his neck. Finally found an abdominal pulse beating faintly just below the breastbone. The noose was sunk deep in his flesh. I groped frantically in my pocket for my penknife. It was a new rope, raw hemp. The fibres were hairy, stained brown with dried blood. I registered the fact faintly in the remote part of my mind that had time for such things while my hands were busy. New ropes stretch. A real hangman has his own ropes, already stretched and oiled, well tested for ease of use. The raw hemp jabbed my fingers, stabbed painfully under my nails as I clawed and pried and ripped at it. The last strand popped, and I yanked it free, heedless of laceration. That hardly mattered. I daren't risk tilting his head back. If the cervical vertebrae were fractured, I could cripple or kill him. And if he couldn't breathe, that wouldn't matter either. I gripped his jaw, tried to sweep my fingers through his mouth to clear mucus and obstructions. No good. His tongue was swollen, not sticking out, but in the way. Air takes less room than fingers do, though. I pinched his nose tight, breathed two or three times as deeply as I could, then sealed my mouth on his and blew.
Had I seen his face as he hung, I would have realized at once that he wasn't dead. His features had gone slack with loss of consciousness, and his lips and eyelids were blue. But his face wasn't black with congested blood, and his eyes were closed, not bulging. He'd lost his bowels, but his spinal cord wasn't snapped, and he hadn't strangled. Yet. He was, however, in the process of doing so before my eyes. His chest wasn't moving. I took another breath and blew, free hand on his breast. Nothing. Blow. No movement. Blow. Something. Not enough. Blow. Air leaking all round the edges of my mouth. Blow. Like blowing up a rock, not a balloon. Blow again. Confused voices over my head, Brianna shouting, then Jamie at my elbow.
"Here's the board," he said calmly. "What must we do?"
I gasped for breath and wiped my mouth. "Take his hips. Bree, his shoulders. Move when I tell you, not before."
We shifted him quickly, my hands holding his head like the Holy Grail. There were people all around us now, but I had no time to look or listen. I had eyes only for what must be done. I ripped off my petticoat, rolled it, and used it to brace his neck. I hadn't felt any grinding or crackling in the neck when we lifted him, but I needed all the luck I had for other things. By stubbornness or sheer miracle, he wasn't dead. But he had hung by the neck for the best part of an hour, and the swelling of the tissues in his throat was very shortly going to accomplish what the rope itself hadn't. I didn't know whether I had a few minutes or an hour, but the process was inevitable, and there was only one thing to do about it. No more than a few molecules of air was seeping through that mass of crushed and mangled tissue. A bit more swelling would seal it off altogether. If no air could reach his lungs by means of nose or mouth, another channel must be provided. I turned to look for Jamie, but it was Brianna who knelt beside me. A certain amount of racket in the background indicated that Jamie was dealing with the spectators. A cricothyrotomy? Fast and requiring no great skill, but difficult to keep open, and it might not be sufficient to relieve the obstruction. I had one hand on Roger's sternum, the soft bump of his heart secure under my fingers. Strong enough? Maybe. Right, I said to Brianna, hoping I sounded quite calm. I'll need a bit of help. Yes, she said. And thank God she sounded calm. What shall I do? In essence, nothing all that difficult. Simply hold Roger's head, pulled well back, and keep it steady while I slit his throat. Of course, hyperextending the neck could easily sever the spinal cord if there were a fracture, or compress it irreversibly. But Brianna needn't worry about that, or know about it either. She knelt by his head and did as I told her, and the mediastinum of the trachea bulged into view as the skin and fascia over it tightened. There it was, neatly lined up, I hoped, between the great vessels on either side. If it wasn't, I could easily lacerate the common carotid or the internal jugular, and he'd bleed to death right under my hands. The only virtue to hideous emergency is that it gives one license to attempt things that could never be done in cold blood. I fumbled for the small bottle of alcohol that I carried in my pocket. I nearly dropped it, but by the time I had poured the contents over my fingers and wiped both my scalpel and Roger's neck, the surgeon's trance had come over me, and my hands were once more steady. I took a moment, hands on his neck, eyes closed, feeling for the faint throb of the artery, the slightly softer mass of the thyroid. I pressed upward. Yes, it moved. I massaged the isthmus of the thyroid, pushing it out of the way, hard toward his head, and with my other hand pressed the knife blade down into the fourth tracheal cartilage. The cartilage here was U-shaped, the esophagus behind it soft and vulnerable. I mustn't stab too deeply. I felt the fibrous parting of the skin and fascia. Resistance? Then the soft pop as the blade went in. There was a sudden loud gurgle, and a wet kind of whistling noise. the sound of air being sucked through blood. Roger's chest moved. I felt it. And it was only then that I realized my eyes were still shut. Chapter 70. All is well. The blackness cradled him, comforting in its warm completeness. He felt some faint stirring of something outside it, a painful, intrusive presence, and shrank back into the shelter of the dark. It was melting away around him, though, slowly exposing parts of him to light and harshness. He opened his eyes. He couldn't tell what he was looking at, and struggled to understand. His head throbbed, and so did a dozen smaller pulses, each one a brilliant, tender burst of pain. He felt the points of pain like pins that nailed him like a butterfly to a board. If he could but pry them free, he might fly away. He closed his eyes again, seeking the comfort of the darkness. He felt a dim recollection of terrible effort, his rib muscles tearing with the struggle for air. There was water somewhere in his memory, filling his nose, wetness ballooning the hollows of his clothes. Was he drowning? The idea sent a faint flicker of alarm through his mind. They said it was an easy death, drowning, like falling asleep. Was he sinking, falling into a treacherous and final ease, even as he sought the beguiling dark? He jerked, flailing with his arms, trying to turn and reach the surface. Pain burst through his chest and burned in his throat. He tried to cough and couldn't, tried to gulp air and found none, struck something hard. Something seized him and held him still. A face appeared above him, a blur of skin, a blaze of reddish hair. Brianna. The name floated into his mind like a bright balloon. Then his eyes focused a little, bringing a harsher, fiercer face into view. Jamie. The name hung in front of him, floating, but seeming somehow reassuring. Pressure. Warmth. A hand was clasping his arm, another on his shoulder, pressing hard. He blinked, his vision swimming, gradually clearing. He felt no air moving in mouth or nose. His throat was closed and his chest still burned, but he was breathing. He felt the soreness of the tiny muscles between his ribs as they moved. He hadn't drowned then. It hurt too much. "You are alive," Jamie said. Blue eyes stared intently into his, so close he felt warm breath on his face. "You are alive. You are whole. All is well." He examined the words with a sense of detachment, turning them over like a handful of pebbles, feeling the weight of them in the palm of his hand. "You are alive. You are whole. All is well." A vague feeling of comfort came over him. That seemed to be all he needed to know just then. Anything else could wait. The waiting black rose up again with the inviting aspect of a soft couch, and he sank gratefully upon it, still hearing the words like plucked harp strings. "You are alive. You are whole. All is well." Chapter 71. A Feeble Spark.
"Mrs. Clare!"
It was Robin McGilvery hovering in the doorway of the tent, his dark wiry hair standing up on end like a bottle brush. He looked like a harried raccoon, the skin round his eyes wiped free of sweat and soot, the rest still blackened with the smoke of battle. At sight of him, Clare rose at once. "Coming!" She was on her feet, kit in hand, and already moving toward the door before Brianna could speak.
"Mother?"
It was no more than a whisper, but the tone of panic brought Clare round as though she'd stepped on a turntable. The amber eyes fastened on Brianna's face for a moment, flicked to Roger, then back to her daughter. "Watch his breathing," she said. "Keep the tube clear. Give him honey water if he's conscious enough to swallow a bit. And touch him. He can't turn his head to see you. He needs to know you're there." "But..." Brianna stopped dead, her mouth too dry to speak.
"Don't go," she wanted to cry. "Don't leave me alone. I can't keep him alive. I don't know what to do."
"They need me," Claire said very gently. She turned, skirts whispering, to the impatiently waiting Robin, and vanished into the twilight.
"And I don't?"
Brianna's lips moved, but she didn't know whether she had spoken aloud or not. It didn't matter. Claire was gone, and she was alone. She felt light-headed and realized that she'd been holding her breath. She breathed out and in, deeply, slowly. The fear was a poisonous snake writhing round her spine, slithering through her mind, ready to sink its fangs in her heart. She took one more breath through gritted teeth, seized the snake by the head, mentally stuffed it wriggling into a basket, and slammed down the lid. So much for panic, then. Her mother wouldn't have left, were there any immediate danger, she told herself firmly. Not if there were anything more that could be done medically. So there wasn't. Was there anything she could do? She breathed, deep enough to make the boning of her stays creak. Touch him. Speak to him. Let him know you're with him. That's what Claire had said, speaking urgently, but somehow absent-mindedly during the messy proceedings following the impromptu tracheotomy. Brianna turned back to Roger, looking in vain for something safe to touch. His hands were swollen like inflated gloves, stained purple-red with bruising, the crushed fingers nearly black, raw rope wheels sunk so deep in the flesh of his wrists that she was queasily sure she could see white bone. They looked unreal, badly done makeup for a horror play. Grotesque as they were better than his face. That was bruised and swollen too, with a ghastly ruff of leeches attached beneath his jaw. But it was more subtly deformed, like some sinister stranger pretending to be Roger. His hands were lavishly decorated with leeches too. He must be wearing every leech available, she thought. Claire had sent Josh rushing to the other surgeons to beg their supplies, and then sent him and the two Findlay boys splashing down the creek banks in hasty search of more. Watch his breathing. That she could do. She sat down, moving as quietly as she could from some obscure urge not to wake him. She laid a hand lightly over his heart, so relieved to find him warm to the touch that she gave a great sigh. He grimaced slightly at the feel of her breath on his face, tensed, then relaxed again. His own breath came so shallowly that she took her hand away, feeling that the pressure of her palm on his chest might be enough to stop its laboured rise. He was breathing, though. She could hear the faint whistle of air through the tube in his throat. Claire had commandeered Mr. Caswell's imported English pipe, ruthlessly breaking off the amber stem. Rinsed hastily with alcohol, it was still stained with tobacco tar, but seemed to be functioning well enough. Two fingers of Roger's right hand were broken, all his nails clawed bloody. Torn or missing? Her own throat tightened at this evidence of just how ferociously he had fought to live. His state seemed so precarious that she hesitated to touch him, as though she might startle him over some invisible edge between death and life. And yet she could see what her mother meant. The same touch might hold him back, keep him from stumbling over just such an edge, lost in the dark. She squeezed his thigh firmly, reassured by the solid feel of the long, curving muscle under the blanket that covered his lower body. He made a small sound, tensed, and relaxed again. She wondered for a surreal moment whether to cup his genitals. "That would let him know I'm here all right," she murmured, swallowing a hysterical desire to laugh. His leg quivered slightly at the sound of her voice. "Can you hear me?" she asked softly, leaning forward. "I'm here, Roger. It's me, Bree. Don't worry, you aren't alone." Her own voice sounded strange, too loud, stiff and awkward. "Bisocho mokria," she said, and relaxed a little. "Bisava, hamishu." It was easier somehow in Gaelic. Its formality a thin dam against the intensity of feelings that might swamp her, were they ever set free. Love, fear, and anger swirled together in a mix so strong her hand trembled with it. She realized suddenly that her breasts were turgid, aching with milk. There had been no time in the last several hours even to think of it, let alone take the time to relieve the pressure. Her nipples stung and tingled at the thought, and she gritted her teeth against the small gush of milk that leaked into her bodice, mingling with her sweat. She yearned toward Roger, wanting suddenly to suckle him, wanting to cradle him against her breast and let life flow into him from her. Touch him. She was forgetting to touch him. She stroked his arm, squeezed his forearm gently, hoping to distract herself from discomfort. He seemed to feel her hand on his arm. One eye opened a little, and she thought she saw a consciousness of her flicker in its depths. "You look like the male version of Medusa," she said, the first thing that popped into her head. One dark eyebrow twitched slightly upward. "The leeches," she said. She touched one of those on his neck, and it contracted sluggishly, already half full. "A beard of snakes. Can you feel them? Do they bother you?" she asked, before remembering what her mother had said. His lips moved, though, forming a soundless no with obvious effort. "Don't talk." She glanced at the other bed, feeling self-conscious, but the wounded man in it was quiet, eyes closed. She turned back, bent, and quickly kissed Roger, the merest touch of lips. His mouth twitched. She thought he meant to smile. She wanted to shout at him. "What happened? What in hell did you do?" But he couldn't answer. Suddenly, fury overwhelmed her. Mindful of the people passing to and fro nearby, she didn't shout, but instead leaned down and gripped his shoulder, that seeming one of the reasonably undamaged spots, and hissed, "How in God's name did you do this?" in his ear. His eyes rolled slowly toward her, fixing on her face. He made a slight grimace, which she couldn't interpret at all, and then the shoulder under her hand began to vibrate. She stared at him in complete perplexity for a few seconds before she realized that he was laughing. Laughing! The tube in his throat jiggled and made a soft wheezing noise which aggravated her beyond bearing. She stood up, hands pressed against her aching breasts. "I'll be right back," she said. "Don't you bloody go anywhere, damn you!" Chapter 72. Tinder and Char. Gerald Forbes was a successful lawyer, and normally looked the part. Even dressed in his campaigning gear and with the soot of gunpowder staining his face, he still had an air of solid assurance that served him well as a captain of militia. This air hadn't quite deserted him, but he seemed visibly uneasy, curling and uncurling the brim of his hat as he stood in the doorway of the tent. At first, I assumed that it was merely the discomfort that afflicts many people in the presence of illness, or perhaps awkwardness over the circumstances of Roger's injury. But evidently it was something else. He barely nodded toward Brianna, who sat by Roger's bed.
"My sympathy is for your misfortune, ma'am," he said, then turned at once to Jamie. "Mr. Fraser, if I might, a word. And Mrs. Fraser, too," he added, with a grave bow in my direction.
I glanced at Jamie, and, at his nod, got up, reaching by reflex for my medical kit.
There wasn't a great deal I could do. That much was obvious. Isaiah Morton lay on his side in Forbes's tent, his face dead white and sheened with sweat. He still breathed, but slowly, and with a horrible gurgling effect that reminded me unpleasantly of the sound when I had pierced Roger's throat. He wasn't conscious, which was a small mercy. I made a cursory examination and sat back on my heels, wiping sweat from my face with the hem of my apron. The evening hadn't cooled much, and it was close and hot in the tent. "Shot through the lung," I said, and both men nodded, though they both clearly knew as much already. Shot in the back,
Jamie said, a grim tone to his voice. He glanced at Forbes, who nodded, not taking his eyes from the stricken man.
No,
he said quietly, answering an unspoken question.
He wasn't a coward, and it was a clean advance. No other companies in the line behind us.
No regulators behind you? No sharpshooters? No ambush?
Jamie asked. But Forbes was shaking his head before the questions were finished.
We chased a few regulators as far as the creek, but we stopped there and let them go.
Forbes still held the hat between his fingers, and he mechanically rolled and unrolled the brim over and over.
I had no stomach for killing.
Jamie nodded, silent. I cleared my throat and drew the bloody remnants of Morton's shirt gently over him. He was shot twice in the back, I said. The second bullet had only grazed his upper arm, but I could plainly see the direction of the furrow it had left. Jamie closed his eyes briefly, then opened them.
The Browns, he said, in grim resignation.
Gerald Forbes glanced at him, surprised.
Brown? That's what he said.
He spoke.
Jamie squatted beside the injured man, a frown drawing his ruddy brows together. He glanced at me and I shook my head mutely. I was holding Isaiah Morton's wrist and could feel the flutter and stumble in his pulse.
He wouldn't likely speak again. When they brought him in.
Forbes squatted by Jamie, at last setting down the maltreated hat.
He asked for you, Fraser. And then he said, tell Ali. Tell Ali Brown. He said that several times before he...
He gestured mutely at Morton, whose half-closed lids showed slices of white, his eyes rolled up in agony. Jamie said something obscene, very softly, under his breath in Gaelic. Do you really think they did this? I asked, equally softly. The pulse thumped and shuddered under my thumb, struggling. He nodded, looking down at Morton.
I shouldn't have let them go, he said, as though to himself.
Morton and Alicia Brown, he meant.
You couldn't have stopped them.
I reached my free hand toward him to touch him in reassurance, but couldn't quite reach him, tethered as I was to Morton's pulse. Gerald Forbes was looking at me in puzzlement.
Mr. Morton eloped with the daughter of a man named Brown, I explained delicately. The Browns weren't happy about it. Oh, I see.
Forbes nodded understandingly. He glanced down at Morton's body and clicked his tongue, a sound mingling reproof with sympathy.
The Browns. Do you know which company they belong to, Fraser?
Mine.
Jamie said shortly.
Or they did. I haven't seen either of them since the end of the battle.
He turned to me.
Is there aught to do for him, Sassenach?
I shook my head, but didn't let go of his wrist. The pulse hadn't improved, but it hadn't gotten worse either. No.
I thought he might be gone already, but he isn't sinking yet.
The ball must not have struck a major vessel.
Even so.
I shook my head again. Jamie sighed deeply and nodded.
Aye. Will you stay with him, then, until...
Yes, of course. Will you go back to our tent, though, and make sure everything's under control there? If Roger... I mean, come and fetch me if I'm needed. He nodded once more and left. Gerald Forbes came near and put a tentative hand on Morton's shoulder.
His wife. I shall see that she has help. If he should come round again, will you tell him that?
Yes, of course, I said again, but my hesitation made him look up, brows raised.
It's just that he has two wives, I explained.
He was already married when he eloped with Alicia Brown, hence the difficulty with her family, you see. Forbes's face went comically blank.
I see, he said, and blinked. The first Mrs. Morton... Do you know her name?
No, I'm afraid I...
Jessie.
The word was barely more than a whisper, but it might have been a gunshot for its effect in stopping the conversation.
What?
My grip on Morton's wrist must have tightened, for he flinched slightly, and I loosened it. His face was still dead white, but his eyes were open, fogged with pain, but definitely conscious.
"Jesse," he whispered again. "Jezebel. Jesse Hatfield. Water.
What? Oh, yes." I let go of his wrist and reached at once for the water jug. He would have glugged it, but I let him have only small sips for the present.
"Jezebel Hatfield and Alicia Brown," Forbes said carefully, evidently noting the names in his neatly docketed lawyer's mind. "That is correct. And where do these women live?"
Morton took a breath, coughed, and interrupted the cough abruptly with a gasp of pain. He struggled for a moment, then found speech.
"Jesse, in Granite Falls. Allie's in Greenboro."
He breathed very shallowly, gasping between words. And yet I heard no gurgling of blood in his throat, saw none oozing from nose or mouth. I could still hear the sucking sound from the wound in his back, and, moved by inspiration, I pulled him slightly forward and jerked back the pieces of his shirt. "Mr. Forbes, have you a sheet of paper?"
"Why, yes, I... that is..."
Forbes had thrust his hand into his coat in automatic response, and come out with a folded sheet of paper. I snatched this from him, unfolded it, poured water over it, and plastered it flat against the small hole beneath Morton's shoulder blade. The ink mixed with blood and ran in little dark runnels over the pasty skin, but the sucking noise abruptly stopped. Holding the paper in place with my hand, I could feel the beating of his heart. It was faint, but steadier. Yes, it was steadier. "I'll be damned," I said, leaning to the side to look at his face. "You aren't going to die, are you?" Sweat poured from his face and the rags of his shirt hung dark and sodden against his chest, but the edge of his mouth trembled in an attempt at a smile.
"No, ma'am," he said. "I ain't."
He was still breathing in short gasps, but the breaths were deeper.
"Allie. Baby's next month. Told her I'd be there."
I picked up the edge of the blanket with my free hand and wiped some of the sweat from his face.
"We'll do our best to see that you are," I assured him,
then glanced up at the lawyer, who had been watching these proceedings with his mouth hanging slightly open.
"Mr. Forbes, I think perhaps we'd better take Mr. Morton back to my tent. Will you find a couple of men to carry him?"
He closed his mouth abruptly.
"Oh, yes. Of course, Mrs. Fraser, at once."
He didn't move right away, though, and I saw his eyes dart toward the wet sheet of paper plastered over Morton's back. I glanced down at it. I could read only a few indistinct words between my fingers, but those were enough to tell me that Jamie's casually insulting references to Forbes as a sodomite were likely inaccurate.
"My darling Valencia," the letter began. "I knew only one woman named Valencia in the vicinity of Cross Creek. In the colony of North Carolina, for that matter.
Farquhar Campbell's wife."
"I'm terribly sorry about your paper," I said, looking up at Forbes.
Holding his gaze with my own, I carefully rubbed the palm of my hand over the sheet of paper, irrevocably smearing every word on it into a mess of blood and ink.
"I'm afraid it's quite ruined."
He took a deep breath and clapped his hat back on his head.
"That is quite all right, Mrs. Fraser. Perfectly all right. I'll go and fetch some men."
This ends Disc 30. The Fiery Cross, Disc 31.
Evening brought relief from the flies as well as the heat. Drawn by sweat, blood and manure, they swarmed over the encampment, biting, stinging, crawling and buzzing in maddening fashion. Even after they'd gone, I kept slapping absent-mindedly at arms and neck, imagining I felt the tickle of feet. But they were gone, at last. I glanced round my small kingdom, saw that everyone was breathing, if with an astounding variety of sound effects,
and ducked out of the tent for a breath of cool air myself. A highly undervalued activity, breathing. I stood for a moment, eyes closed, appreciating the easy rise and fall of my bosom, the soft inrush, the cleansing flux. Having spent the last several hours in keeping air out of Isaiah Morton's chest and getting it into Roger's, I was inclined to cherish the privilege. Neither of them would draw a single breath without pain for some time, but they were both breathing. They were my only remaining patients. The other, seriously wounded, had all been claimed by the surgeons of their own companies, or taken to the governor's tent to be tended by his personal physician. Those with minor injuries had gone back to their fellows to boast of their scars or nurse their pains with beer. I heard a ruffle of drums in the distance and stood still, listening. A solemn cadence played and stopped abruptly. There was a moment's silence in which all motion seemed suspended, and then the boom of a cannon. The Lindsay brothers were nearby, sprawled on the ground by their fire. They too had looked up at the sound of drums. "What is it?" I called to them. "What's happening?"
"They're bringing up the dead, Mrs. Fraser," Evan called back. "You'll no be worried, eh?"
I waved to them in reassurance and began to walk toward the creek. The frogs were singing, a descant to the distant drums. Full military honours for the battle dead. I wondered whether the two hanged ringleaders would be buried in the same place, or whether some separate and less honourable grave would be set aside for them, if their families didn't claim them. Tryon wasn't the sort to leave even an enemy to the flies. He would know by now, surely. Would he come to apologise for his mistake? What apology was possible, after all? It was only by the fluke of fortune and a new rope that Roger was alive. And he might still die. When I set my hand on Isaiah Morton, I could feel the burning of the bullet lodged in his lung, but I could feel the stronger burning of his ferocious will to live in spite of it, too. When I set my hand on Roger, I felt that same burning, but it was a feeble spark. I listened to the whistle of his breath, and in my mind I saw charred wood with a tiny patch of white-hot ember still alight, but trembling on the verge of abrupt extinction. Tinder, I thought absurdly. That's what you did with a fire that threatened to go out. You blew on the spark. But then there must be char, something for the spark to catch, to feed on and grow. A creaking of wagon wheels made me look up from my contemplation of a patch of reeds. It was a small wagon with a single horse and a single driver.
Mrs. Fraser, is that you?
It took a moment for me to recognise the voice. "Mr. McClellan?" I asked, astonished. He pulled up alongside me and touched a hand to his hat. By starlight, his face was dim and grave in its shadow. "What are you doing here?" I asked, drawing close and lowering my voice, though there was no one anywhere near to hear me.
"I came to find Joe," he replied, with a slight motion of his head toward the wagon bed.
It should have been no great shock. I'd been seeing death and destruction all day, and I was no more than slightly acquainted with Joe Hobson. I hadn't known he was dead, though, and the hairs rippled on my forearms. Without speaking further, I went round to the back of the wagon. I felt the small jerk and vibration through the wood as Abel put on the wagon brake and got down to join me. The body wasn't shrouded, though someone had laid a large half-clean kerchief over the face. Three huge black flies rested on it, still and bloated. It made no difference, but I dashed them away with the back of my hand. They drifted up, buzzing, and settled again, out of my reach.
"Were you in the fighting?" I asked,
not looking at Abel McLennan. He must have been with the Regulators, but there was no smell of gunpowder on him.
"No," he said softly behind my shoulder. "I'd no wish to fight. I came with Joe Hobson, Mr. Hamilton, and the others. But when it looked as though there would be fighting, I came awar. I walked away as far as the mill on the other side of the town. And then,
when the sun went down and no sign of Joe, I came back, he finished simply.
What now?
I asked. We both spoke softly as though we might disturb the dead man's slumber.
Shall we give you help to